Isaiah chapters 11 and 12, the 10th talk in a series on Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on September 30, 2012, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Isaiah chapters 11 and 12. These chapters are short, and I don't have a lot to say about them, but this is the last section in the introductory material to Isaiah. And starting with chapter 13, it's a pretty sharp break and gets us into a whole other set of things. So I'm just going to do chapters 11 and 12 today, and then start in on 13 next time. And I have some comments I'm going to make at the end, but I never know till I get there how long my comments will be at the end. Depends how verbose I choose to be at the time. But there might be quite a bit of time for questions, so be thinking of questions. Where we left off at the end of chapter 10, it's talking about the destruction of Assyria, the arrogant Assyria that is going to be a tool of God to come in and punish the people of Israel. But then Assyria itself will be punished. And the metaphor that's used in verses 33 and 34 is that God is going to bring them down like trees in a forest. They're all going to fall. And he's talked earlier about tall things being brought down, tall things being symbolic of things that seem to be powerful, that seem to be impressive. Those things will all be brought down. And so that's where we left off at the end of chapter 10. Now it's going to pick up, I think, in that same context. I'll read the first five verses. Then a shoot will bring from the stem of Jesse, will spring from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. And the Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. And he will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make a decision by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he will judge the poor, and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. And he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Also righteousness will be the belt about his loins, and faithfulness the belt about his waist. There are a couple of times in what we've already gone through in Isaiah where there has been reference to a shoot or a branch that comes up. The first one is just an allusion to the possibility of a shoot or a branch, and that's 6:13. Here it's talking, the context, if you'll recall, is God is speaking to Isaiah, and Isaiah asked, God says what he wants him to do and what he's supposed to tell his people, and basically it's going to be, I'll speak, but you won't understand, and not until your cities are devastated and without habitation and the houses are without people, this suffering is going to go on. And it concludes in verse 13 saying, yet there will be a tenth portion in it, and it will again be subject to burning, like a terebinth or an oak, whose stump remains when it is felled. The holy seed is its stump. So Israel is going to be wiped out. All that's left will be a stump, but it's the stump of an oak tree. And as I understand it, a new oak can grow from an oak stump. So there's the potential here of a reemergence. And it has talked before about a remnant. And it says in the last line, the holy seed is its stump. So this passage is suggesting, it doesn't say it, but it's suggesting there will be new growth that will come from that stump. In 4:2, in the passage for a little over a chapter, it's been talking about Israel, and in particular, its corrupt leadership. That its leaders are rotten, they have taken advantage of their power. In particular, they have taken advantage of the powerless. And furthermore, in the last part, it talks about the women of Judah. And I think it's in the context, what it's referring to is the wives and the daughters of the leading group, the aristocracy. And there it talks about their arrogance. And there's going to be a judgment that occurs on the leadership in particular, but all of Judah as well. But then in verse 4:2, it switches gears and says, in that day the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. And it will come about that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy. Everyone who is recorded for life in Jerusalem, when the Lord has washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and purged the bloodshed of Jerusalem from her midst by the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning, then the Lord will create over the whole area of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day, even smoke, and the brightness of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory will be a canopy, and there will be a shelter to give shade from the heat by day and refuge and protection from the storm and the rain. So there will be a, after the discipline, there will be a branch of the Lord that will be beautiful and glorious. So something reemerging. It's just a small part. It's as if the tree was rotten, but there's going to be a healthy shoot, new sprout that comes up. And I think the allusion at the very end of that in verse 6, there will be a shelter to give shade for the heat by day and refuge and protection from the storm and the rain. It could possibly be indicating this branch has grown into a tree and is providing the shade and the protection. So there are two passages then that we've looked at that are suggesting that out of the remnants of Israel will come something truly glorious. It'll just be from the remnant, but something glorious is coming. And in our passage today, it begins with a reference to that same branch or shoot. And it refers to it as a shoot springing from the stem of Jesse. And why the reference to the stem of Jesse? The son of Jesse is David. David became the king after Saul. And it was David to whom God made the promise that there would be an everlasting kingdom. Let's look at that. 2 Samuel 7:12. I'll just read 12 and 13. This is a promise that God makes specifically to David. He says, when your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant after you who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. So a promise was made to David, the son of Jesse, that there would be an everlasting kingdom that would come out of him, that would be a descendant of his. And so this reference to the root of Jesse is probably would bring that to mind to the readers, that's the promise that's being referred to. Why would it say the stem of Jesse? And I don't know that I know the answer to that, but I suspect what has happened is that since the time of David, all of the kings of Judah have been descendants of David. And there is probably an aura that's developed about around the king of Judah, of the king of the Davidic line, that he is really something special, which is true in a sense. But I suspect that that concept has, they've taken that and it has gone to their heads. And I would suspect that there is, in some parts of Judah, probably a little bit of animosity towards the king who has claimed that title but hasn't lived up to the expectations of that title, who has used that title as an excuse to rule and even rule unrighteously in the name of that promise. But David came from very humble origins. David came out of Jesse, family of Jesse. And I suspect that might be the case, that that's why that phrasing was chosen. Now, this shoot or this branch that comes out, is that talking about one person or is that talking about a group of people? Are we talking about a remnant in the sense of a whole group, or are we talking about one individual? As we go on, I think it's quite clear that it's focusing on the ruler. But I think in the context of all we've seen in Isaiah, it really has both in mind, that the remnant is both a group of individuals, but it's a group of, and a leader, but it's a group of individuals who are committed to the leadership of God and a leader who is committed to righteousness. So I think the shoot and the branch are actually both, but the focus of this section is going to be on the leadership. God's Spirit is going to rest on him, and he is going to be characterized by certain qualities that are important for a leader. And using the terminology that I introduced last week, this would be attributive giftedness. That is, gifts given to the leader that become the attributes of that leader. And those attributes are spirit of wisdom and understanding, a spirit of counsel and strength, a spirit of knowledge, and the fear of the Lord. Those are the things that it identifies. Most of them having to do with being able to perceive and understand what's going on and therefore what would be appropriate to do in a particular situation. Verse 3 goes on to say that he will delight in the fear of the Lord, and the fear of the Lord is central to this. And he will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make a decision by what his ears hear. I find that refreshing, that what it's talking about is a leader who exercises wisdom and is able to see past appearances and see to the root of a problem and address the root of a problem rather than the superficial manifestations of that problem. He's not prejudicial. He does not judge by what his eyes see. And he will judge with righteousness, he will judge the poor and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. So his a clear concern for and a genuine concern for those who are disadvantaged, those who are powerless in one way or another. Those are the ones who get taken advantage of in any society because they don't have power. They're the easiest to take advantage of. And he will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. By merely speaking, he's able to deal out justice and righteousness. It's easy for him. And righteousness will be the belt about his loins, and faithfulness the belt about his waist. So it's righteousness and faithfulness that are characteristic of his reign. Next section. And the wolf will dwell with the lamb, and the leopard will lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little boy will lead them. Also the cow and the bear will graze. Their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. And the nursing child will play by the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child will put his hand on the viper's den. They will not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea. Now it's describing what will be the consequences, the outcome of this, of the rule of this righteous ruler. We've seen what qualities he has. We've seen how those qualities work their way out in the way that he administers the society, the government. Now, what is the outcome of that? When I have looked at this in the past, I have taken this literally. If you take this literally, then we've got biological changes taking place. We have carnivores that are no longer carnivores, they're herbivores now. And that may be possible, that may be what heaven is like, but I'm inclined to think in context that this is figurative, as I've thought about it more. Some people have taken this to be spiritually figurative, that is, that the conflict, the tension between sinfulness and righteousness will be resolved, and sinfulness will be completely harnessed. There will be no more viciousness as a result of sinfulness being harnessed. Possible, but I'm not inclined to go that direction. I don't think that that fits best in the context. I think what fits best in the context is that this is figurative language that's describing the harnessing not of sinfulness as much as viciousness. That is, we've got a situation in which the young, the most vulnerable, the baby sheep, the baby lions, the baby cows, and the baby people are all safe and secure. They are not victimized. They are not eaten up. They are not the victims of predation by the vicious. And I think that's probably the import of this. That would fit best in the context. That's kind of what had been an ongoing theme here, and that is, what is happening to those in your midst that are powerless? And what's happening is they are being taken advantage of. There are people that are gaining by abusing them. So we have the reference to a little boy will lead them. Later on it says the nursing child will play by the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child will put his hand on the viper's nest. Three references to a young child, which I find interesting because we have had a young child popping up through this whole introduction. It's been a young child has been used in a couple of metaphors that he has used. As you'll recall in chapter 10, verse 19, how destroyed will Assyria be? And the rest of the trees of his forest will be so small in number that a child could write them down. Interesting incorporation of a metaphor. He could have used a lot of other metaphors to make that same point, but he uses a child there. There's another one. I should have written that down. I think there's one more. But we also have a child when Isaiah is to give a sign to Ahaz. He goes with his son. And then when he goes to appear before Ahaz, he asks Ahaz what kind of sign that Ahaz wants from God. And Ahaz declines, so God gives a sign of God's own choosing. And what is that sign? It's a child. Later on, there's another promise of a child in that same context. And then we have the section in chapter 9, verse 6, "For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, etc." And we went through that before. I think that what Isaiah has done is set up a child as being indicative of that which is vulnerable, that which is relatively powerless, that which is innocent. And then he's saying that it will be a child that comes that fulfills that role of the Messiah that he's describing in chapter 9, which is a shocking way for the Messiah to come, the way to think about the Messiah, that the Messiah doesn't come with a huge display of power, but he comes as a vulnerable, relatively powerless being rather than a powerful being. And here then, I think that same metaphor is being used for a child. Here it's not the Messiah, but it's the powerless. It's the vulnerable. And God is identifying closely with the powerless and the vulnerable, and therefore the Messiah, as it's talking about here, will be protective of those who are powerless and vulnerable. And that's the kind of environment that will be established. Next section. "Then it will come about that in that day that the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, who will stand as a signal for the peoples, and his resting place will be glorious. Then it will happen on that day that the Lord will again recover the second time with his hand the remnant of his people who will remain from Assyria, Egypt, Pathros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. And he will lift up a standard for the nations, and will assemble the banished ones of Israel, and will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. Then the jealousy of Ephraim will depart, and those who harass Judah will be cut off. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, and Judah will not harass Ephraim. And they will swoop down on the slopes of the Philistines on the west. Together they will plunder the sons of the east. They will possess Edom and Moab, and the sons of Ammon will be subject to them. And the Lord will utterly destroy the tongue of the sea of Egypt, and he will wave his hand over the river with his scorching wind. And he will strike it into seven streams and make men walk over dryshod. And there will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant of his people who will be left, just as there was for Israel in the day that they came up out of the land of Egypt." Okay, so the time is coming then. In that, it says, "Then it will come about in that day that the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, who will stand as a signal for the peoples, and his resting place will be glorious." So in this environment established by the Messiah, then the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, that they will be attracted to and come to this place. They will come to this person who will stand as a signal for the peoples, for them to all come. And his resting place, I think what that means is the place of rest that he establishes, will be glorious. And I'll talk about that in my concluding comments a little bit more. "And it will happen on that day that he will again recover the second time with his hand the remnant of his people who will remain." So it sounds like that there are going to be two times in which God will gather his people together, gather a remnant together. And they're going to come from, and it lists the places that they will come from, and they are essentially Mesopotamia, That would be Assyria. Egypt, Pathros, and Cush would all be Egypt and Ethiopia. Elam, Shinar, and Hamath. Elam and Shinar would be in the east. Hamath would be basically Syria. And then the last category from the islands of the sea, and I assume that means the islands of the Mediterranean. So what it's roughly talking about are those areas to the east, those areas to the south, and those areas to the west. And in all likelihood, what that is indicating is from all of the inhabited world for the time of Isaiah. So his remnant will come from all of the inhabited world on two different occasions. And it says he will lift up a standard for the nations and will assemble the banished ones of Israel and will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. He's setting up a standard. If you will recall, there was a reference to a standard being set up earlier in Isaiah. It was a standard being set up by Assyria. And it was attracting to that, calling to that standard, soldiers from all over Assyria to come together and to march on Palestine, to march towards Israel. Well, now there's another standard. That standard was quite ominous. If I were a movie maker, I could do that scene where it's gathering the people from Assyria, the soldiers, to march against Israel. A windswept hill, and just a standard is all you can see going up and blowing in the wind, and then these war-hardened soldiers eagerly gathering to go on their march. But now we have another standard being set up that's gathering a different people for a very different purpose. It's gathering the remnant of Israel. So instead of being an ominous event, there's something hopeful and encouraging about this standard. In verse 13, it talks about the jealousy of Ephraim departing, and those who harass Judah will be cut off. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, and Judah will not harass Ephraim. It's talking about peace between the two halves of the nation of Israel, that the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah, will be reconciled. There will no longer be tension between them. So we've got this remnant coming back, presumably representatives from all 12 tribes, coming back to Palestine, coming to the lifted standard, and there's no longer tension between them. Verse 14 then talks about them swooping down on the slopes of the Philistines to the west and plundering the sons of the east. So it's describing a situation in which the traditional enemies of Israel and Judah are conquered, and that Israel no longer is threatened by its neighbors. It indeed controls those areas. And verse 15 is talking about God, and 16, God paving the way for his people to come back. That the tongue of the Sea of Egypt will be utterly destroyed. He's going to wave his hand over the river, and that's generally a reference to the Euphrates. With his scorching wind, he will strike it into seven streams and make men walk dry shod over it. And then in Assyria, a highway will be made for his remnant to return. I don't know if this is to be taken literally. It's possible. It could very possibly be a literal description of the things that will happen that will make it possible for the remnant to return. But I think it is also possible that this is figurative, and that what it's describing is ways in which God makes it possible for the remnant to return to Israel that are miraculous, that they are similar to what had happened when the people came out of Egypt. And when that happened, God acted very overtly in history with miracles. And so what's being described here I'm inclined to take figuratively, but I don't know. It could be that it would be, it is intended to be literal. But if I look at history, I suspect that it's to be taken figurative, if I'm correct in identifying the two times when God has gathered his remnant. So let's talk about that. I suspect that what he's talking about is that the first time that God collected the remnant was after the Babylonian exile, that some came back from Babylon and to help reestablish Judah as a Jewish state. And when that happened, people that were dispersed into other parts of the world, some of them came back as well. And that happens over a long period of time. There are still people coming back to Palestine at the time of Jesus. There are also people leaving Palestine, but there are people coming back as well. So I'm inclined to see that as the first gathering. It takes over a long period of time. It's over, what, half a millennium is the period of time over which God is gathering in people from various parts of the inhabited world. But then, after the death of Christ, it's in 70 AD, Jerusalem and the temple are destroyed, and the people of Israel are dispersed, and they go all over the world, literally all over the world, spreading out as far as China, they're into Africa, all over the world. I think the second gathering then is started with the Zionist movement in the late 1800s, and that has been a time of Jews from all over the world making their way back to Israel, and they have literally come from all over the world. I was curious as to whether in Israel today that there would be people who trace their lineage back to every tribe. Would there be every tribe represented in Israel today? And I asked my daughter that, and she sent me a bunch of website links. And I looked those up, and I was not able to identify individuals in Israel who traced their lineage back in every tribe, but I was able to identify at least 9 tribes that some group of people in Israel trace their lineage back to. And I suspect that if I were to look harder, I'd find the other 3 tribes represented as well. And people have come from all over the world, and under quite unusual circumstances. The one that I'm most familiar with is Jews who are living in the Soviet Union. And if you had asked me, would Jews in the Soviet Union be allowed to leave, if you had asked me that in 1970, I would have said, no way, never happen. But it did happen, and the first wave of those that were released happened in the late 70s. There were changes within the Soviet Union political makeup that made it seem like that was a good move for them to make. So they opened the doors for a period of time, and then they shut them. But 10 years later, with the fall of the Soviet Union, those doors were open again, and an even larger number of Jews left the Soviet Union. A pretty remarkable turn of events in a relatively, historically speaking, a relatively short period of time. And there were so many Jews that left the former Soviet Union in the early 90s that 1/3 of the population of Israel today is from this former Soviet Union. And that influx of people has created all kinds of interesting dynamics within Israeli society. So I think that the second gathering either has happened or is happening. That's where I would place it in history. But it's always difficult to place these things. We'll talk about that a little bit more at the end. Okay, chapter 12. We'll do it in one fell swoop. Then you will say on that day, I will give thanks to thee, O Lord. For although thou wast angry with me, thine anger is turned away, and thou dost comfort me. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid. For the Lord God is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. Therefore you will joyously draw water from the springs of salvation. And in that day you will say, give thanks to the Lord, call on his name, make known his deeds among the peoples. Make them remember that his name is exalted. Praise the Lord in song, for he has done excellent things. Let this be known throughout the earth. Cry aloud and shout for joy, O inhabitant of Zion. For great in your midst is the Holy One of Israel. So when this happens, when they're gathered back in Israel, it will come to pass that the people of Israel will recognize what has happened in history. That is to say, they will recognize that what God had predicted had come to pass, and what God had predicted is that they would be punished. They would undergo suffering for an enormous amount of suffering over an extended period of time. But they'll look at that and they'll say, God, you were angry at us, but your anger is turned away and thou dost comfort me. The time has come when they're able to put that history into perspective and say, that happened. I understand what happened. I understand the purpose for what happened. And it has been a good end that has come from that. And we are comforted knowing where that has led to, the good that has resulted from that. As a result, they will joyously draw water from the springs of salvation. And they will say, give thanks to the Lord, call on his name, make known his deeds among the peoples. In other words, broadcast what has happened. Enlighten other people as to what is going on in history, what history is all about, where this has all been leading. And praise the Lord in songs, for he has done excellent things. Let this be known throughout the earth. Cry aloud and shout for joy, O inhabitant of Zion, for great in your midst is the Holy One of Israel. And the Holy One of Israel is a phrase that has shown up a couple of other times in Isaiah, and it seems to be distinctive to Isaiah. Okay. In this last this section, it's interesting that there are, it seems to me, a few allusions to the text in Genesis. The places it's described in that figurative language that I was talking about, where children are with vicious animals, is kind of a Garden of Eden-like place. Secondly, it talks about knowledge, the knowledge of God that fills the land. In, if you recall back to the account in early Genesis, what was at stake was the knowledge of good and evil. And Adam and Eve opted. They wanted to have the knowledge of good and evil, and they wanted to have it on their terms, in their way. So they ate of the fruit. It talks about that knowledge of God covering the earth with a water-like, with a covering that's like the sea, I think it says, which is reminiscent then of the flood. And then it talks about the resting place. And as you will recall, in the flood, at the end, Noah's name means a place, means rest. And at the end, they were comforted with, and had rest from the flood, from the judgment of the flood. I suspect that those allusions are intentional, and it causes, I think, one to reflect on what is the difference between the Garden of Eden at the beginning of history and where history is headed to, the new heavens and the new earth. And it strikes me that it is interesting and significant that history is not, did not start at the Garden of Eden, and then man became rebellious, and there's this bad dream that extends for a few millennia as a result of man's rebelliousness, but then God gets things right and sticks us back into the Garden of Eden. That's not history. That's not the story that God wanted to tell. The story rather is we started out in the Garden of Eden in a state of innocence, and God has used our rebellion to help us to understand truly, significantly, what is good and what is evil, and brought us to the place where we choose God. We understand the option before us, the choice that we have before us. But he brings us to the place that we truly value that which is good, such that we embrace that which is good fully and completely. And so he takes us to a new place. It's not the Garden of Eden, as Jacques Ellul talks about it. It's interesting. It's a city. Even though throughout the Bible, the city has been symbolic of kind of the evil of man in concentrated form. And yet, we're going to go to a city. That's where we're going to go. But it will be a city that God has redeemed. God has transformed. So we aren't going back to the Garden of Eden. We're going forward. We're going to something that's new and different. We are going to have a different state of being than was experienced by Adam and Eve. And it will be better. It won't be obedience because we don't know how to choose evil. But it will be obedience because we do know how to choose evil. We understand the nature of evil, and we have turned our backs on it. The second thing that I want to point out is I find it curious that in the end, there will be a ruler. That we as human beings have a nature that is such that we look to leadership. Leadership is important to us. We are sheep-like, and I don't mean that in a negative sense. We are just herd animals. That's just built into us. And we need leadership. And that will not be done away with, curiously. There will be leadership in the new creation. And that leadership, as best I understand it, will actually do things. It will actually lead. It will actually judge. It will play the role that it ought to have played throughout human history, but hasn't. I find it interesting. And so we aren't going, having not thought about this before, I think I would have envisioned heaven as being a place of anarchy. But everybody's good, so they all do what's right. I don't think that's quite the picture. The picture is there will be leadership that will lead. We will do that which is good, but we will have leadership that will help us sort that all out. I think heaven will be more challenging than we think it will be. But that's good, because it won't be boring. Okay, third thing I want to talk about. What qualities are necessary in a leader? That is, what kind of leadership do we need? If we are by nature those that look to leadership, what kind of leadership would serve us well? And we're coming into an election season, so I am going to become a little bit political here, but I'm going to talk theory. We are by nature, we have three qualities that really stand out. One is we are self-centered. The second is we are myopic, that is to say, we short-term is far more interesting to us than long-term. And we focus on the short-term. And we don't think about what would be the significance of these acts in the long-term. And thirdly, we tend to be focused on appearances. It seems to me that what the kind of leadership we need is the kind of leadership that encourages us to rise above those weaknesses, that encourages us to not be self-centered, that encourages us not to be myopic, and that encourages us to look beyond appearances to the substance of things. A leader's, one of the main jobs of a leader, I think, and I'm borrowing from Bill Moore here, when he sends emails, it has something to this effect on it, is the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. And I like that a lot because it's so true. It's so important. It's so easy to be distracted with things that are less significant and lose focus on that which is really central and really important. It seems to me that a leader's primary job is to help us keep the main thing the main thing. And in order to do that, it requires wisdom, understanding, knowledge, strength, and it all starts from the fear of the Lord. And those are the qualities that were talked about in the passage. We live in a society that is democratic. That is both fortunate and unfortunate. There are many things that I like about democracy, but there are things that I don't like about democracy. And one of those is, in a democracy, the easiest way to gain votes is to exploit people's weaknesses rather than to help them rise above them. And that was not just discovered in the United States of America. That goes way back to Greek times, and I'm sure it goes back even further than that, that politicians realize that the way to get votes, the way to be popular, is to exploit the weaknesses that are built into us as human beings in order to gain political power. Let me just talk about one example. And it seems to me that, from my perspective, this is a problem on the right and the left. I think we have a problem that's pervasive in society, that we have politicians that for years have been encouraging us to be self-centered, myopic, and to just look at appearances, and we've done it. If we just take one example, and I could give several examples, but I just decided to choose this one, I think we would all agree that the poor should be of concern to us. That's what Isaiah's been talking about. That's an issue for him, is the treatment of the poor within in the society of Judah. So, if the poor should be a concern to us, then what do we do about that? Speaking very broad-brushedly, on the Democratic side, the solution is give them more money. They need resources. They need wealth. Where are we going to get that? Oh, and that has two benefits. It benefits those who didn't have money. It just also happens to benefit the rest of the population in that we can feel good that our society takes care of the poor. And where are we going to get the money to do that? Well, we'll either print it or we'll take it from the wealthy. That's a nice move because the wealthy are relatively few voters. There are lots of voters out there that are either poor or in the middle somewhere who don't make over, $200,000 a year, whatever the line is. But the thing that I find aggravating is there genuine concern for the poor here? Are we really helping the poor? And that's an issue that isn't generally explored. Now, if we look on the Republican side, their position tends to be, from my perspective, more philosophical, and in fact, I am more inclined in this direction. Their perspective is, we need to understand that you can't just help the poor by giving them money. the real problem, the root problem, most significant problem is they need to be helped to help themselves. And on that side of the aisle, they're skeptical of what government can do, especially with respect to welfare. Can government run, do welfare? So their answer is, we can focus on the economy. If we just improve the economy, then everyone will benefit. There will be more opportunity for the poor. The thing that strikes me is that both approaches make it possible to feel good about yourself and ignore the poor. What happens on the Democratic side is we've got these programs in place. It should be helping the poor, so we don't really need to worry about whether it is helping the poor. We're doing what we can. On the other side, it tends to foster an attitude, and for reasons that are unknown to me, I watch the financial shows on Saturday mornings on Fox, and they say some things sometimes that take my breath away because they betray a perspective that whatever wealth you have is equal to the effort that you have put in to making wealth. So if you're poor, what you been doing? Why weren't you out working? And so they equate so much that it is your responsibility, and their assumption is if you work, you will make money. And I challenge that assumption. I don't think that's true. What bothers me is on both sides of the spectrum, they've created the possibility to feel good about themselves because there's a sense in which they care about the poor on the one hand, but on the other hand, not really care about the poor. I don't have a solution to the problem. I'm not offering a solution to the problem. I think it's extremely complex. But my concern is politicians just want to give the semblance of caring about the poor. There are very precious few politicians that care about really addressing the problem in a way that is wise, that makes sense, and that will work out providing dignity to the poor, and the help that makes sense will get them on their feet so that they can support themselves. We love appearances. And all you have to do is give me the appearance that you're doing something good, and I will give you the credit. And the politicians are playing into that big time and just doing appearances. We could talk about other issues. We could talk about education. We could talk about foreign policy. We could talk about the economy. But I think the same thing gets repeated in each of those areas. And in a democracy in which the people have the weaknesses that I've described and vote out of those weaknesses, the leadership keeps getting worse. I think that it is genuinely true that it is ultimately our fault when we have an absence of good leadership. We have been foolish. The last thing I want to talk about is I find chapter 12 here in Isaiah extremely encouraging. The biggest day in history, the happiest day in history, is coming. Now, sorting out prophecy is difficult, and we will see this as we proceed in Isaiah. There's several problems with sorting out the prophetic presentations. One is establishing chronology is extremely difficult. People have used the analogy of mountains in the distance, and it's hard to tell which ones are in front of which other ones. And I think that's a helpful analogy. That's certainly true in the prophetic writings. Everything is kind of, there's very little perspective. It's hard to tell which is beyond what. Identifying when a prophecy has been fulfilled is difficult. Oftentimes the prophecies are given in terms that are poetic, and there aren't a lot of specific details that are given such that you can match it with a historical record with confidence. And the third is what we've already run into, and we'll run into it a lot more, is when do you interpret a prophetic passage as being literal, and when is it figurative? We'll find that a challenge in a number of instances as we proceed. So I am not confident in my knowledge of the prophetic literature. In fact, I actually don't know it very well. But I think it's consistent with what I've read elsewhere and what I see here in Isaiah 12, that the day is coming when the Jews as a whole will come to understand their role in history. And they're going to repent and turn to God. I was reflecting on this. I was reading the story of Joseph for another purpose earlier on the weekend. And I was struck by the fact that there are some interesting parallels between the story of Joseph and the nation of Israel. I've looked at that before, and I've thought about the parallels between Joseph in that story and Jesus. But I hadn't thought about the parallels between Joseph and the Jews. But there's a sense in which they fit together quite well. That is to say, that God, early in history, established a people that were his chosen people, that he was going to bless. And he gave them a status above all of the other peoples of the world. And the result of that was a jealousy of the rest of the world towards Israel. And if you recall in the Joseph story, Joseph had a dream where all of the brothers bowed down to him. And that's what made him really mad. That's why they decided to kill him. As we learn from prophecy, that Israel will have a preeminent place. And in particular, the Messiah will be the ruler that comes out of Israel. And so what they do, they were going to kill him. They were going to kill Joseph. Wipe him out. Wipe him out and all your problems are solved. That's a solution that's being offered in our day with respect to the people of Israel. But he wasn't killed. He was sold into slavery. He goes to Egypt. And in Egypt, he becomes the salvation of the very people that wanted to kill him. And there is a verse at the end of that passage that is one of my favorite verses in all of the Bible. And that is when, after Jacob dies, the brothers of Joseph are afraid, since he is now the number two man in all of Egypt, he could do with whatever he wanted to his brothers, that now that their father is dead, there will be nothing that will keep him from getting his vengeance. And Joseph learns of that, and he is saddened by that. He is saddened that they have responded that way because they don't know him very well. They don't know what's happened to him, because he has learned a lot through the experiences that God has brought his way since the time that he was sold into slavery, such that he reaches the point where he says to his brothers, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." And I think what's being described here is the time when the Jews are going, as a whole, are going to come to that understanding and embrace that and recognize history hasn't been a lot of fun for us. That our people have suffered an enormous amount, and people meant to do harm to us. But in the final analysis, in the story that's been told by God, it is a marvelous story. It is a phenomenal story. And we have played the role that God wanted us to play. We understand that and embrace that role, and we have no bitterness. And when the people of Israel come to the place where they embrace that perspective, I think that will be the greatest, the most celebratory day in history. That will be an incredible event. And it is yet to come. It has not yet come, I think it's fair to say. Okay. That's all I plan to say. Any questions or comments?
Thank you. And I think you said this, but I think I spaced out. In chapter 11, verse 11, in that day the Lord will reach out his hand a second time to reclaim the remnant that he left, that is left to his people from mm-hmm. all these places. Mm-hmm. The first place being, the first time being taking them out of Egypt?
No, I think the first gathering, I think what he's talking about is the first gathering is bringing them back from Babylon.
Okay. And so then the second one, did you say that you thought it was happening now?
Mm-hmm. And I think the Zionist movement marks the beginning of that. So starting in the early 1800s, or the late 1800s, and I think still happening, yes.
So your understanding is it has begun, like mm-hmm. the beginning of chapter 12 of in that day, in that amazing day that.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Okay,
so that's my question too. Is the end of the second gathering? Does that result in that day where no more bitterness?
That will happen. That is yet to happen. The in that day is mm-hmm. it's hard to know exactly what it means by that. I think that day is more than 24 hours. We're talking about a long period of time, mm-hmm. and if you look at all of the occurrences of that phrase in that day, at first I thought, well, it's always associated with God's judgment on his people. But it isn't always associated with God's judgment on his people. It seems to indicate that period of time in which God is acting to bring about his final purposes in history.
Okay.
I think that's what it means. And that day, I think, extends over centuries. But it's a long day.
Okay, and that long day. Your understanding that that's on this side of eternity, that is something, yeah.
I don't know. That's where those mountains are difficult.
Uh-huh.
I don't know where this is with respect to the new heavens and the new earth, mm-hmm. for sure. I'm still working that out. I'm inclined to think that what's described in chapter 12 happens just this side of the new heavens and the new earth, but I don't know that. I can't say that confidently yet.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So is 6 through 9, do you take that to be definitively the new heavens and the new earth, or could that also be the site of?
6 through 9 in chapter 11?
Yeah, the wolf dwelling with the lamb, et cetera, et cetera.
And is that this side of eternity or the other side of eternity?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Okay. Because what strikes me is he's just finished talking about the ruler who's going to rule, and then I really like what you do with that as being a metaphor. That makes a lot of sense, a lot more sense. But what would make sense would be the reason there's no harm coming to the children and so on is because they have a protector.
Yes.
And the only thing I don't know about the eternal kingdom of God is whether there's need for the same kind of protector as there would be here and now in this mm-hmm. in this age. So mm-hmm. an enforced peace by the king of peace makes kind of sense out of this passage, mm-hmm. it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. So you would be inclined to put it this side.
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. And then so then in 10 on, in that day, is probably going back to when the spring from the stem of Jesse arises. Mm-hmm. Once he arises, in that day the nations will resort to the root of Jesse, etc.
Right.
And then you have subsequently the regathering that
right.
So
right. My problem is I have so many pieces that need to be put together with respect to the prophetic picture that it's particularly hard for me to put them in right order.
And on a less human level, on the biological level you were talking about earlier, about on that section Jack uh-huh. mentioned, you leaned figurative. I don't know if you leaned because you thought that a biological shift would have to happen or what drove that as far as making it figurative, and I liked what you did with that. But either way, if dovetail with what Jack said, if before or after it's that day, if it's not the children necessarily, but the other animals, mm-hmm. if they stop victimizing each other, then there will have to be a biological shift because a carnivore necessitates. So how did you think about that?
Well, the reason that I'm taking it figurative rather than literal is primarily because it makes better sense in context that what's at issue here is what will happen to the vulnerable and powerless. That really fits in well with everything that he's talked about up to now. And talking about metabolic changes in animals would be going in a completely different direction. So that's the main reason that I am inclined to take it figuratively that way.
But if there's a let's just call it a peace between lion and goat,
mm-hmm.
meaning you don't necessarily think you think it's poetry when he's talking, or an illustration, it might not really be lions and goats right, in the kingdom
right.
anyway.
Right, right.
Okay.
I don't know what animals will be there, and I don't know how they'll treat each other. I claim ignorance with respect to that. I don't think that's what it's talking about here. I think it could be that lions will be there and they won't eat people, but I think what it's really intended to say here is that the vulnerable will no longer be victimized.
And the only reason he alludes to the animal kingdom is to use it as an illustration
yes.
of a picture. Okay.
Yes.
Hey, David, real quick. You know, the whole notion of a ruler in the Old Testament, it seems to imply that God will still sort out issues that are occurring between people that have been saved. And so my question is, our sense of self, our self-centeredness, I suspect that that's going to be carried over into the next life. So I wonder, with our sense of self in that self-centeredness, how does that play out? I wonder if it seems like there's still going to be conflict between people. Not that but we're going to deal with it very differently.
Yeah, I don't know. And my picture of eternity has changed over the years. It seems more likely to me, and I'm more inclined to think that eternity is going to be, there's going to be a lot of continuity between our experience here and eternity. But I think what we're promised is that we will be perfect, that we will understand who God is with respect to us, and that we will relate to Him rightly, and there will be peace, there will be justice, there will be righteousness. But exactly how that, what that looks like, and what our experience will be there, I'm inclined to think that it won't be all that different from what we experience now. I mean, that there'll be a lot of continuity there, and I think there will still be challenges. There will still be problems. There will still be things to work out or whatever. And I don't know what those will be. I don't know exactly what that will look like. But it only makes sense that it would still be a challenging environment, one in which we continue to learn, continue to grow in some way, etc.
Yeah, those interpersonal sparring matches I don't think are going to end here.
I don't know what they'll look like, but I suspect there will continue to be challenges that we deal with. And that's great. That's what'll make life interesting. Okay, thanks.